His 13th district congressional race has been endorsed by the Sierra Club and by fellow Democrat and U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. Gill's GOP opponent, Rodney Davis, recently received the endorsements of Illinois State Treasurer Dan Rutherford and Activator, the Political Action Committee of the Illinois Farm Bureau. So, less than 90 days from the election, it would appear we have entered political endorsement season. But here's the question. So what? Do you, as a voter, care who endorses who for what office? Do political endorsements matter? To discuss the perceived value of political endorsements, we're joined now by Kent Redfield, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Kent, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Good afternoon.
So, do political endorsements matter?
They matter, but often not that much. They provide voting cues for, particularly for low-information voters. So, you know, if you're interested in agricultural issues and Activator, which is associated with the Farm Bureau, endorses a candidate, then, you know, that is a shorthand that allows you to say, okay, this person's pretty good on the issues that I care about. Or similarly with the Sierra Club. Individuals, it's a little bit different. You can lend your credibility to someone. And that's probably the situation in terms of Durbin endorsing Gill. It's not a huge headline that one of the leaders of the U.S. Senate from Illinois is endorsing a Democratic candidate running for Congress from Illinois. But, you know, it's more likely that, a press release about that is going to get picked up because Durbin's name is in it than, you know, Dr. Gill putting out a policy statement on nuclear non-proliferation or something like that. So you can lend credibility, and sometimes in primaries we've seen, you know, dueling conservative icons, Huckabee versus Palin in the last in the Missouri race, where you've got someone that comes in and again lends credibility and name recognition. And it's, you know, it's a cue that allows you to kind of maybe make a decision without investing a lot of time, you know, on the internet or reading position papers.
Is it a bigger deal, perhaps, when someone in that position, maybe a senator, a governor, a congressman, or a former office holder, or someone who's sort of a big name, doesn't endorse a given candidate, including one from his own party?
Yeah, if you've got a lack of endorsements and the Democratic Party in one of the southern states just, I think it was Tennessee, pretty much disavowed their candidate for the U.S. Senate because in a primary where you had a bunch of people running and nobody really wanted to take on the incumbent Republican senator, you got someone with some very un-Democratic Party ideas. Now, a big name, you know, a political name probably carries more weight than a celebrity name. I'm not sure that the fact that Kobe Bryant is apparently raising money for Barack Obama and Ted Nugent is very enthusiastic about Mitt Romney's campaign, that's probably not going to translate into a lot of votes directly on election day. No one's going to say, gee, I want to vote for this person because Ted Nugent endorsed them or Kobe Bryant endorsed them.
But do even the big names in politics really make that much of a difference? You mentioned that for some voters who maybe aren't paying close attention, there are certain cues that they can gather from certain organizations or certain individuals that, based on what I know about that politician or based on what I know about that organization, maybe that means this is closer to the person I'd want to vote for. But do you think there's anybody that's truly just swayed by one endorsement?
Generally not, unless you are a real single-issue voter. And you're a real single-issue voter, and you're pro-life, and, you know, the candidate has probably told you already that you're pro-life, but you get the organization, the pro-life organization, or the flip side of that in Illinois would be the personal PAC group. So it helps on the margins, and sometimes when it's a contrast, when you've got labor endorsing a Republican candidate, or you're going to see Democrats for Romney, and you're going to see Republicans for Obama, and You're trying to tell people who don't have a strong party identification that this person is, you know, bipartisan, that he appeals to both sides. And so, you know, you do it because you're out looking for any advantage you can get and trying to get something on the margin to get a little edge. But it's not going to overcome, you know, if someone clearly doesn't seem to be up to the job, if someone has policy positions that are quite out of step with the congressional district they're running in, then all of the celebrity or political endorsements or organizational endorsements in the world really won't make a difference.
Kent Redfield is professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Kent, thanks for talking with us.
Certainly.
It's 1246. Since the end of communist rule, Poland's economy has grown stronger. Its GDP has been growing at about 4% a year recently. Poland is part of the European Union, but not yet part of the single currency eurozone. A collapse of the euro, however, could have profound implications for Poland. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
So one factor that's kept Poland somewhat insulated from the eurozone crisis has been domestic consumer spending. Poland had more than 4% growth last year, while the rest of the continent was mired in negative or flat growth. And Poles have more discretionary income than ever before, and they're using it, purchasing things in swank malls that are cropping up all over the country.
Consumer spending has risen significantly in recent years, notes Mirosław Bojarczyk as he shops at Warsaw's Golden Terraces Mall. I think it's because of malls like this, he adds, which allow people to buy a wider variety of products in nice surroundings. And this spending is a driving force behind our economy. Just over 20 years since the end of communism here, rampant consumerism is now embraced as Poles feel like they're trying to catch up with Western Europe. But with the debt struggles of Greece, Spain, and others daily news here, many Poles see danger signs ahead. Paweł Jóźwicki, who works installing air conditioners, is not hesitating to buy a new washing machine as he shops at a chain store in central Warsaw. But he is having second thoughts about his country's plans to eventually join the euro single currency. I really think it's best to stay with our own currency, like Great Britain did, he says. They stayed with their own money, and today they're able to take care of themselves a lot better. The anxiety is well-founded. Poland's economic destiny is deeply tied to Europe. About 80% of its trade is with European Union countries, about 30% with neighboring Germany, Europe's largest economy.
If you're a Polish investor sitting on cash, you're looking on the disaster which is happening in the eurozone, you're simply afraid of investing big money.
Ryszard Petru, a partner with PwC in Warsaw, says many Polish companies are now investing enough to keep operations going, but they're holding off making big-ticket investments in infrastructure, expansion, or hiring.
You're going to think twice or three times before you do it, because if Europe breaks up, nobody knows what's going to happen. So in other words, what we see, hesitation, people are very cautious, and they're postponing big stuff.
And that can have a ripple effect. Poland's economy is diversified, but not so diverse it could absorb a eurozone shock. Poland's finance minister, Jacek Rostowski, recently warned of potentially serious risk to the Polish economy from the debt saga. The nature of the threat is we don't know exactly how severe it will be. I warn it could be very serious, he said. Adding to the economic apprehension here is the forthcoming big drop in public spending. Poland has been the biggest benefactor of EU structural funds for highways and other large infrastructure projects. Poland pumped money into gigantic ventures, including roadways and stadiums, ahead of co-hosting the Euro 2012 soccer tournament in June. In all, it's estimated Poland's total preparations for Euro 2012 amounted to more than 5% of GDP. Now that massive de facto stimulus program is over. Still, banker Joseph Wanser, chairman of the American Chamber of Commerce in Poland, says this is no time to panic.
The fact that its GDP is not 4%, but it's 2.8, should not be interpreted that it's a catastrophe. It's still excellent and much better than in most other countries. It's a slowdown. We are dependent on what's happening in our region, in Europe, what's happening globally.
Wanser notes that few Polish banks today dabble in exotic derivatives or are badly exposed to Spain's disastrous real estate holdings. He believes Poland can withstand some shock if the euro crisis deepens and spreads, but he quickly adds a caveat, saying nobody knows to what point we can hold out. There's no country in the area that's strong enough to resist a tremendous attack if it comes from all sides, he says, or if the Eurozone starts to break apart. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Warsaw.
WILL programs are made possible with support from The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 13th of August, 2012. 1961, on this date, construction began on the Berlin Wall, cutting off East Berlin from the West, from the part of the city divided up by the British, the French, and the Americans. The Soviets had East Berlin, and after the war, millions of East Germans emigrated west. By 1961, they were leaving at a rate of 1,000 per day. So in the early hours of the morning, East German soldiers began laying down barbed wire, 100 miles of it, just inside the border. It was on this day, 1918, a woman named Offa Mae Johnson became the first female Marine. The Marines were recruiting women to enlist as reservists to do clerical duty stateside during World War I and to free males for combat duty. Offa Mae Johnson, the first. She was 18 years old. It's the birthday of the novelist Tom Perrotta, born in Garwood, New Jersey, 1961. Grew up in blue-collar Newark. Went off to college to study creative writing, but he said he didn't want to write for the people he met in college. He said, "I wanted to write for the guys I grew up with who weren't literary sophisticates. I have an allergy to fancy writing." Most recent book is The Leftovers, about what might happen if the rapture didn't quite live up to evangelical expectations. Stephen King called it the best Twilight Zone episode you never saw. It's the birthday of Alfred Hitchcock, the movie director, London, 1899. His father was a greengrocer, and once when the little boy misbehaved, his father sent him to the police station, and they locked him in a cell for a few minutes to teach him a lesson. And Hitchcock, for the rest of his life, was so terrified of the police, he would not drive a car for fear that he might be pulled over. Alfred Hitchcock, who directed Rear Window, Vertigo, Psycho, and The Birds, and who said, "A good film is when the price of the dinner, the theater, and the babysitter were worth it." And it's the birth